Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. Thanks so much for being with us. And on this Thanksgiving week, we are grateful for you for listening. In a moment, we're going to head to USC to talk to some of the top political experts in the country. But let's begin this week with Congresswoman Karen Bass, who is now Mayor-elect Karen Bass. We've been covering this mayor's race literally from the start. We talked to her on her first day as a candidate, and on her last day as a candidate. We moderated two of the key debates in the race. We talked to her family for the first time. And now we're talking to her as mayor-elect for the first time. We headed to her congressional office, which will soon be closing as she moves into City Hall. Here's that conversation.
Congresswoman Bass, Madam Mayor-elect, how's that sound? Has that sunk in yet?
Well, it's sinking in. It's beginning to sink in. But every time I hear it, it's definitely daunting, and I'm just very excited.
I mean, was there a moment where you're like, oh my God, I'm going to be the mayor?
I think it was the moment that Zach came in and said, they called it. And I was like, they called what?
Yeah.
He said, you're the mayor.
Yeah, and Zach is your communications guru.
Yes, who will be with me in City Hall.
And you were in this office,
yes,
right?
Yes,
and,
yes.
And then saw it on TV.
Yes, I still have this day job.
Yes, yeah. and you know, we've talked a lot over this campaign,
yeah.
And done a lot of interviews, but my favorite interview was the one that we did with your kids.
Uh-huh.
And Yvette, your daughter, told me that last year, she came to you and said, you should run for mayor, and you told her, you're crazy.
Exactly.
She's not looking so crazy now, right?
How
do you wrap your head around this, where you literally thought this could be an impossibility, and now you're actually here?
Exactly. Well, she definitely continues to point that out. But, you know, I just didn't see it. It wasn't something that I was planning. I think most people, when they take on something like this, they've thought about it and planned it for a number of years, but I didn't. But what drew me in, as you well know, was I was just compelled to address what's happening in Los Angeles. And so I am ready to get to work and get to work on day one, and I'm going to work extremely hard.
We know this was a contentious race.
Yes.
Rick Caruso, there was a lot of support for him too.
Yes.
And there was an article by Erica Smith, the LA Times columnist, suggesting that he should maybe be the housing czar, and okay, this idea that he knows how to build, and that the two of you as a coalition would really send a strong message to LA. Does Erica Smith have a point?
Oh, she absolutely has a point. And I look forward down the line to working with Rick. Absolutely. As you well know, we had a fine relationship before. And I viewed a political race like an athletic competition. Both teams fight against each other as hard as they can. But when the race is over, it's over. And so down the line, I absolutely would look forward to working with him. But what I have to focus on right now is pulling an administration together, because we have a very short time frame. It's not like you could do interviews and begin to hire people or make job offers before you even know whether you got the job. So I literally have 3 weeks, and I want to pull my administration together. I want to launch a 100-day plan, and I absolutely will look to see if he is open. I am certainly open.
So, I mean, have you guys spoken since that concession call, and would you consider him for a big job right now as part of that administration?
We have not spoken since then, and I'm really just trying to pull my administration together. So whether or not, you know, he would even be interested in a big job, you know, we have to see.
Seems like one of the only big-time Democrats who didn't endorse you was Governor Gavin Newsom.
Yes.
Have you spoken to him since this?
We have texted each other, but I haven't spoken to him. But we actually are arranging a call with each other right now, because his text message to me was definitely saying he wants to be helpful, and I need help.
And I know you've also met with the current mayor, Eric Garcetti. What
yes.
was his main message
yes.
to you?
Yes. Oh, his main message was definitely of support, anything he can do to help make this a smooth transition. And, you know, I know if he doesn't go off to India soon, I know that he will be there for me, and I look forward to his assistance. But I also received a call from Air Force One and Air Force Two.
Mm.
Both the president and the vice president were traveling to and from Asia, ironically, and they both called me to tell me, one, to congratulate me, but to also say that they will be there to help Los Angeles.
And how key do you think was their support Because it's not every mayor's race gets the president and the vice president to come to the city and campaign with the person.
And the former president.
Right.
You know, President Obama. I think it was very important because, as you said, on that level, they don't endorse in mayoral races. But I think and I hope what it demonstrated to Angelenos is that I have the relationships, and we need all of those relationships to help Los Angeles. We cannot do it on our own. Of course, we need money, but we also need regulatory relief, and that can only occur on different levels of government.
What actually changes, though, in real people's lives on day one when you take over?
Well, on day one, a message is what people will hear. But I will lay out a 100-day plan, and that 100-day plan will involve identifying some of the most challenging encampments around the city and getting those people housed. I think it's critically important that people visibly see a difference. It's not just enough to tell them that something happened, that something has changed. They need to be able to see it, feel it, and touch it.
So your first priority is cleaning up encampments?
The first priority will be identifying some of the most challenging encampments. I'm not saying they're going to go away in 100 days, but I am saying that we are going to target throughout the city a number of the most challenging ones and get people housed. Not just move them away, because that's something that has always concerned me, and you know that. It's not enough. I mean, it actually doesn't do much of anything if you move the encampment 3 blocks away, or if you move it all the way to the other side of town. The point is to get people housed. But the other thing that I'm concerned about is that the money that came in for COVID relief, some of it is running out. And I'm worried that we might actually have a spike in homelessness when people who are currently housed in motels and hotels are told they have to leave.
And last question, when you put that hand on, I guess, the Bible or whatever you swear in on, and you take that oath and you become the first woman and the second African American, and people see you in that role, what is that moment going to mean to you, and what do you think that moment means to this city?
Well, I hope to the city it means that we can have a change and people can be hopeful, because our city has been in a situation that is negative, and it's just been one hit after another, whether you're talking about what happened in city council, what people see on their streets, the fact that it's so difficult to live here. So I hope when they see me that they feel a renewed sense of hope in our city. And for me, it is a tremendous responsibility, and a responsibility that is daunting, but a responsibility that I'm just extremely honored that I'll have an opportunity to have.
Well, Madam Mayor-elect, thank you for being so kind during this process. And it is great to interact with a person of integrity in this way. And
thank you.
Best of luck to you in this new role.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Congresswoman Bass. Now we take you to USC for a special conference, the USC Warshaw Conference, looking at the midterms. Here's our report with some of the biggest names in politics.
The current population in the United States, by best estimates, is now 333,426,875. You cannot tell me, out of that many people, we can't find somebody under 75 to run this country. I just don't believe it. I don't accept it.
Legendary Democratic strategist James Carville, who helped to run Bill Clinton's 1992 presidential campaign, and Reince Priebus, former RNC chair and Trump White House chief of staff, speaking together at the Warshaw Conference at USC.
James, you said that the Democrats should nominate somebody on the planet under 75. Who is that person, or maybe the top two or three people that you think would be the most effective candidates for the Democrats? Who, Reince, do you think would be the toughest candidate to run against on the Democratic side?
My favorite would be Mitch Landrieu, the former New Orleans mayor, who I think is just one of the most staggering communicators I've ever seen.
A lot of people in my party would disagree with me and think, oh no, California governor is never going to make it. I think Gavin Newsom is someone that would be dangerous. I mean, for Republicans. I do think that. I mean, he'll moderate. I know most Republicans are like, oh no, you can't. He can't get over all the, you know, the crazy California liberal stuff that goes on. But I think he would be a formidable Democrat.
This day-long conference featuring some of the biggest names in political punditry. I served as one of the moderators. It's organized by the USC Center for the Political Future, which is run by longtime Democratic strategist Bob Schrum, a former top aide to John Kerry and Ted Kennedy, and veteran Republican strategist Mike Murphy, a former top aide to John McCain and Mitt Romney. The event focused on analyzing what they call the midterm madness.
This was one of the most interesting midterms we've ever had, because all the historical trends that are normally right, you know, bad economy, unhappy electorate, punish the president, didn't happen. So this thing was an outlier, which makes it fascinating.
This was a historic midterm. The first time a Democratic president had this kind of midterm since 1962, when JFK actually gained seats in the Senate, lost, I think, three seats in the House. And the first time a Democratic president since 1934 in his first midterm has not lost a single state legislative chamber.
The only other time in recent history where a midterm has gone the other way for the president in power was 2002, after George W. Bush was there, and that was Osama bin Laden managed to make it not about Bush, but about him. And now Trump has repeated that trick to the great detriment of the Republican Party.
This election was not a referendum on Joe Biden. It was a referendum on Donald Trump.
Among the panelists, Barbara Boxer, who served California in both the House and the Senate, and Jon Favreau, former chief speechwriter to Barack Obama, now the co-host of Pod Save America.
I think the big takeaway from the midterms is there's a price to pay for running extreme candidates that are far out of step with most of the electorate. And I think that's the price that a lot of the Republican candidates paid in the midterm.
To me, the biggest takeaway is the young people made the difference in these key races. And it turns out they don't like insurrections. They like democracy, they like control over their own bodies, and they want hope, and they want people to be treated with dignity.
What would you say is your big takeaway from the midterms?
Return of the swing voter. Yeah, independents really kind of broke of the incumbent party, which rarely happens. And the chairman and I were talking, it was about 7% more Republicans voted Democratic than 2% Democrats voted Republican. And the actual turnout was pretty favorable to the Republicans. And so we had forgotten about the swing voter, but they asserted themselves.
Do you think that's also the case, that the swing voter is back?
Well, certainly they made the difference. And we live in a hyper-polarized country right now where people are in their corners more than ever before. You have states like Wisconsin where you've got polling at 48-48 with just 4% in the middle, and the parties are spending almost $300 million fighting over 80,000 people. Mm-hmm. So when you have that little slice in the middle, I think the Democrats just throttled us in university towns and did a good job on wedge issues. And it only takes a little bit to win, and I think they did a good job of it.
America's comeback starts right now.
Days after the midterm, your old boss, Donald Trump, who you were chief of staff to, announces he's running for president again. What do you make of that, and what do you make of him as a candidate now?
Well, I mean, he's got a voice. I mean, there's a clearly. I mean, he represents, you know, for a lot of people, they've had enough, and he's going to have a voice. But I also think that clearly there's going to be a primary. And I think you're also seeing people in the Republican Party saying, you know what, a big primary is a good thing. We want to hear from everybody. So I think that's a change, too, because 2 weeks ago, you were hearing, you know, maybe Ron DeSantis is going to get in, but maybe in the end he probably wouldn't if Trump gets in. Well, that election also created a situation where now it looks like there's going to be a big primary.
He's back. Donald Trump is there again.
Man.
What do you make of his announcement and the fact that he's doing this?
I mean, I'm not surprised that he's doing it, because I think he has sort of like a bottomless well of need to be in public life and to be in the spotlight. But the announcement was interesting because I think they wanted to keep him on message, so he read a prompter speech. But he's always very low energy and sort of bored when he reads a speech, because I think he's never found a speechwriter who actually knows his voice. So in an attempt to keep him on message, he also just seemed bored. It was a pretty low energy affair, I thought.
You literally ran a group called Republicans Against Trump. Do you feel like you're getting more company now? What do you make of this moment? Is the party ready to move on, and are the voters ready to move on?
Well, as we say, the phones are ringing off the hook. You know, we've been to this movie. We said this guy is poison. We're going to lose the election. We did it in 18. We did it in 20. Now third time's the charm. I can feel that Republican voters at every level, some still like Trump, but everybody wants to move on. So we're in a very different political world, particularly for President Trump, than we were 30 days ago.
For me, the hour's come for a new generation to lead the Democratic caucus that I so deeply respect.
Nancy Pelosi's decision to leave her Democratic leadership post was a hot topic at the Warsaw Conference at USC that I helped to moderate. Barbara Boxer served in the House with Pelosi starting in the 1980s.
Will the gentlelady yield to me? Will the gentlelady yield to me?
I yield to my colleague. Yes.
I want to compliment my colleague from San Francisco on her excellent remarks.
How do you define Nancy Pelosi's legacy?
Nancy Pelosi is extraordinary. I don't think there's ever been a speaker in history, because I've done some reading and I was in the House for 10 years, never really a speaker who could get so much done with such a small majority. You know, just sometimes a few people. That meant she had to persuade everybody. So she had to get people who were very diverse in their thinking, you know, from pretty far left to center to a little right of center, to agree on legislation. And I can't even explain to you the dynamic of that. And also, mostly men who, you know, didn't really get us when we first came. When Nancy came in 1987, I had been there since 1983, there were 12 Democratic women out of, you know, hundreds of people. And it was crazy. I mean, people looked at us like, is something wrong with them? You know, why are they here? And here she rises to the top to speaker.
When Jon Favreau worked as Barack Obama's chief speechwriter, he often saw Pelosi's work up close.
What do you want young people to look back on her and know?
I think she's the most effective Speaker of the House in American history. I think the sheer amount of legislation she has been able to shepherd through Congress, it's just unbelievable being able to keep a caucus together like that. She is a master tactician, she's a master legislator, and I think generations will look back at her not just as like the first woman speaker in the history that's made, but just the greatest speaker of all time.
When Reince Priebus worked as Donald Trump's chief of staff, he witnessed Pelosi behind the scenes.
What's your sort of takeaway on Nancy Pelosi's legacy?
Well, I think she was a good leader for the Democrat Party, and I think she was someone that she was easy to work with when I had things that had come up and she needed some help. When I was in the White House, she'd called me a couple times for some help on a few things, and she was polite. And, you know, I'll let the Democrats write their own awards and ceremonies for Nancy Pelosi. I'm not going to rain on her parade. She worked hard, and she served the country well, and I'm sure she's a patriot.
For 40-plus years, James Carville has watched Pelosi's work for the Democratic Party.
What do you think is Nancy Pelosi's legacy?
Maybe the greatest congressional leader of all time. I'm serious. Okay, certainly of my lifetime. I mean, the idea that she ran that House with a four-vote majority, and you're going to start seeing 100 pieces saying, where's the Republicans' Nancy Pelosi? But I can tell you one thing. I know Nancy Pelosi, and I know Kevin McCarthy, and Kevin McCarthy is no Nancy Pelosi.
Democrat James Carville and Republican Reince Priebus are friends despite their political differences. They spoke together at a USC conference in the midst of hyper-partisan times.
What can we all learn from that?
Well, I think you can learn that for the most part, there are lots of folks that get along with each other in politics that might not agree with each other on policy. So I know that James loves his country. He's a proud Marine. He's a patriot. And we can do more of this.
You literally married a Republican, so you know something about bipartisanship.
I have been in his living room raising money for the Republican National Committee. Now, he hid in the kitchen and didn't come out. I think he shouted a few things during my speech.
The USC Center for the Political Future is run by Democrat Bob Schrum and Republican Mike Murphy.
Does this conference show that people can sort of come together?
Well, yeah, it shows that we can come together in civil disagreement. We may disagree about why things happen. We may disagree about what we want for the country. But we can do it in a way where we respect each other and we respect the truth, which is what we're trying to do here at the Center for the Political Future.
It's possible to have fierce opponents, but they don't have to be your enemies. It's not I'm right, you're evil, so I have to destroy you. It's I'm right, you're wrong. Let's have a fair fight about it. You know, I always joke, being from Michigan, that after the Michigan-Ohio football game, we don't burn the stadium down and kill everybody. We train for the next game. We got to bring that back to politics. Common set of facts. Strong disagreements and debates, but not enemies, not destruction, not hate that tears the country apart, because I don't know about you, I'm a little old to learn Chinese. I'd like America to stay number one, and this is not how we do it, tearing ourselves apart.
Thanks so much for listening this week. Again, a very happy Thanksgiving to you. Hope you take a moment to express some gratitude and have some time to chill out. I'm Alex Michelson. We'll see you next week for more of The Issue Is.